This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey everybody, this is Christelle Alonso and I am boldly going where no man has gone before. Or maybe they have. I don't know what kind of life you live. You're listening to Joy 94.9.
This is Allison Bechtel. I'm a big dyke. And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Queen on Joy 94.9.
There's an element of horror to the film. And I think, yeah, audiences have said this, you know, that when you're talking about horror and particularly female bodies, female adolescent bodies, There's audience expectations.
Trying to break your wrist?
What do you care?
Dang, dancing must really got you weak. Dang. Hold up. Come on now, Tom. What's wrong?
I'm scared.
Scared? Scared of what? Silent your mind. Trust me, they gonna get better.
Monster, but what we're talking about is a very internal fear that Tony is going through, and so it's not this external thing that's going to come and get her. It's actually something that's growing inside of her stronger and stronger throughout the entire film. So, you know, our philosophy as filmmakers is to make films that ask questions, that allow for conversations after the end credits, and that's what's really exciting for me is, you know, we definitely go into allegorical space in this film, and that means that every viewer is bringing their own, you know, lens and interpretation to the film, and it's really exciting, I think, because everyone, you know, has such a singular vantage point, but also when you talk about adolescence and the obstacles that we all overcame, there is kind of a universal feeling, but there's also very specific, individual, unique experiences that people bring to their viewings, and it colors the film, and that's really exciting. We say all answers are the right answer.
Yeah. Cool. It's early in the morning over there for you, no doubt, 7 a.m. or something?
Yes, and I know it's late over there.
No, hey, it's only 9 o'clock, actually. But thank you so much for doing this so early in the morning. I hope you've had a coffee or something to remedy that. This is Sonia for Broad on Joy 94.9, and we have a chat to the director, writer, and producer of The Fitz. It's Anna Rose Homer talking to us from New York, I believe.
Yes.
Oh, you are.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you. It's great to have you talk to us at this time of the day.
Oh, no worries.
yes, so The Fitz, this is an exclusive limited season. are playing at the ACMI, ACME, here in Melbourne Town in Australia. And it's only playing until the 10th of July. Who knows? If all goes well, it might get extended and picked up at other cinemas in the country, I'm hoping. And I know you get asked this all the time, but can you explain what The Fitz is about?
Yeah, you know, I feel like every time I give a description of the film, it becomes more and more sparse. But here's my go, is that The Fitz, you know, it's a narrative feature, but it's a genre-blending film. It's part psychological horror, part dance film about this young tomboy named Tony as she's navigating the space of group of girls for the first time in her life.
Yes, it's an intriguing film. It's been described as, you know, one of a beguiling mystery, meticulous mood of psychological isolation. It's just from the Sundance Film Review in January, so of this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly getting a lot of attention. How do you feel about that for this debut film of yours?
It's really exciting. You know, we made this film entirely with grant support. Our key funder was the Venice Biennale. So to make a film, you know, really outside of the system in the U.S. With nonprofit support, and then have it, you know, travel the world, and you know, the fact that even a limited audience in Australia can see this in the theaters is so satisfying to us as a team. And it's really exciting, all the press and praise, and yeah, no, just it's a real honor to have your first film kind of land and travel the world in this way.
Since it's release in the US as well, some theatres from June the 3rd, it's getting a few more added to that list, which is fantastic. Quite a few more.
In the States, actually, the theatre we opened on June 3rd, we're a month later, we're still in the same theatre. So it's getting held over and we're getting
cool
added cities. I think we're, you know, over 35 cities in the US, and that's growing. So it's very exciting for my team as a whole.
Yeah, so it looks like, yeah, held over. It says here the New York, the Metrograph held over, the Esquire Theatre held over in Cincinnati, which is great because it's based in Cincinnati, isn't it?
Yeah, we shot the entire film in Cincinnati. We collaborated. Mm-hmm. We actually cast a real dance team in our film. So all 45 mm-hmm. girls in our movie actually dance on the same dance team in the West End of Cincinnati. And we collaborated with that team. They have a couple hundred girls. In reality, we cast, like I said, 45 of them, including our lead actor, Royalty Hightower, who plays Tony in the film. She's actually been dancing on the team since she was 6 years old. So
wow.
It was a real community effort. And really, you know, we're so grateful for the generosity of that community. And it's so meaningful to be able to play the film there in Cincinnati.
Yeah. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about the film itself, that it's like something that I've not seen myself, and I'm sure a lot of people have said the same thing. It's like being a kind of fly on the wall or a slice of life of a very rare look at a community of ordinary girls in Cincinnati, a place that you don't hear about much outside of, I guess, America itself.
Mm-hmm.
So why, how did
yeah,
it come about?
You know,
sorry.
We worked really closely with the girls. I co-wrote the film with two other women, my editor, Celia Davis, and my producer, Lisa Kuroff. And, you know, we had a very formal screenplay with a lot of choreography. I mean, it's not a dialogue-driven film. It's a movement-based film. So when we went to collaborate with the Q Kids, the dance team we cast in the film, we actually really workshopped all of the dialogue and spent about 6 weeks before we started shooting really playing and experimenting and incorporating the girls themselves as really authors in the process. And I think that's where a lot of that authenticity kind of lived in aesthetic comes from. Although it's completely fiction, very stylized, almost dips towards magical realism, there it's kind of grounded in this really, you know, inclusive voiced narrative that includes teenagers who rewrote all of their own dialogue and, you know, who really practice in the space we're shooting. So I think that kind of mix of realism and hyper-realism, kind of subjective reality, is really interesting in the film and something that excited me from its onset.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It comes across as incredibly, you know, natural, but again, very imaginative. There's this super real or hyper-realism to it, which is helped by the cinematography. Yeah. Where did you come up with the idea of the how the film would look? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I collaborated very closely with my cinematographer, Paul Yee, who I've known for, I think, about 13 years now. And actually, my background is in camera. I went to the university to study cinematography. So I felt really comfortable, especially in that collaboration, really pushing it to a very specific look. And that was something we talked about really early on, was just, you know, how to bring the audience into our main character's subjective vantage point. And a lot of that was done through cinematography. Even the choice to shoot in 2-3-5, which is, you know, the traditional very wide landscape aspect ratio that's used for Westerns, is that, you know, when we, even if we framed Tony's character in a close-up, there would be all this empty space around her and kind of pointing towards her isolation and her loneliness. And, yeah, we play a lot around with lensing and focus, then also with color palette. My costume designer, Zachary Sheets, and my production designer, Charlotte Royer, and Paul Yee and I really talked about color and making very distinct color choices in the quote-unquote boys' world, which is this boxing gym, and the girls' world, which is the dance gym. You know, in the boys' world, you have very primary red, blues, golds, black, white. And then in the girls' space, we introduce secondary colors, teals, purples, kind of these in-between hues. And we tried to keep that very exclusive. And, of course, Tony is, you know, bouncing back and forth between these two spaces, so her wardrobe includes both. But yeah, the look was something that, you know, we spent a lot of time making sure that we were controlling palette and kind of the aesthetic of the space. Even though we were shooting in the community center where they actually practiced, we were able to paint the walls and
yes, I wanted that,
and really kind of focus in so that the audience is really experiencing this world from Tony's perspective.
Yeah, I thought you might have painted some of the walls when she goes down the corridors. There's those distinctive colors that keep repeating again and again, the purple and the yellow and that blue, I think it is, or teal.
Yeah.
And it just keeps repeating again and again. It's like her eyes are always your eyes type of thing. I can't explain it, but I'm trying. I'm trying to explain it. But I see what you're trying to do there, and it's just enhances the whole experience. It's a really a film that it's it also has a feeling of a solitary experience as a viewer. Like, I'm sure you've had people who've gone along to it and with a group of people watching it together, but I'm sure you've got people who, in my situation, where I came out thinking something totally different from the person sitting next to me and so on.
Yeah, we love that, actually. You know, it's, you know, we leave, you know, our philosophy as filmmakers is to make films that are, that ask questions, that allow for conversations after the end credits. And that's what's really exciting for me is, you know, we definitely go into allegorical space in this film. And that means that every viewer is bringing their own, you know, lens and interpretation to the film. And it's really exciting, I think, because everyone, you know, has such a singular vantage point, but also when you talk about adolescence and the obstacles that we all overcame, there is kind of a universal feeling, but there's also very specific, individual, unique experiences that people bring to their viewings, and it colors the film, and that's really exciting. You know, we say all answers are the right answer.
Yeah. Now, of course, the question of, and because I'm an outsider and Australia is an outsider as a whole continental culture, the question I think that I have to ask is, of course, the question of colour and the question of them being African-American girls, and what was the impetus for that representation?
Yeah, well, we had been writing and researching for almost a year before we found the Q Kids, and that initial kind of outline and story structure didn't dictate race or location. Okay. There was just something more fundamental about the story that we were telling. We started to look for a dance team to cast. Simultaneously looking for a team, we were looking for a dance form itself, because we did have some very specific ideas about, you know, we wanted a dance that was its own sport, that had a competitive nature, that was group-based. So, you know, it did kind of start to narrow our choices. And then when we found Thrill, actually found on YouTube. The first video I saw of a stand battle, which you see repetitively throughout the film, was the Q Kids dancing. And I just really fell in love. There was an inherent kind of call and response built into the dance form. And, yeah, I just felt like it was the right form for the film. And then we approached the Q Kids to be our collaborators, and they really dictated the, you know, that their team as a whole, you know, was what made the racial makeup of the film, and that our location in Cincinnati, all that came from the casting decision to collaborate with this team for our film. And, you know, yeah, it really grew from there.
Mm. Yeah, I guess it is a question people have asked me from, well, a lot of white Australians have said, oh, they're all black kids. And I've gone, yep.
Yeah.
So I guess, and you being white, obviously, well, I'm presuming as such, that has, I guess, come in a lot recently.
Yeah, you know, currently. I think part of the process, you know, I co-wrote with two other women. We all come from different backgrounds. Mm. And Tony's always been a conglomerate of the three of us. And I think, you know, when we first started writing this, if we had closed our eyes and imagined Tony, she probably looked, you know, in each of our heads, just like ourselves. I think that we, you know, when I still see the film, when I see Tony, I see my own experience. I really connect with her as me. And, you know, when we started to work with the Q Kids and set in an all-black cast, you know, the way I put it is everything changed and nothing changed. You know, fundamentally, we really didn't change a lot about the structure of the film. It was about the specifics, and it was also about, you know, taking a step back and really listening to the community where we're filming and allowing the cast to be part authors of the process and really include their voices and their experiences and really go at it understanding that you are not an expert on anyone's experience except for your own, if that, and be open to listening and collaborating in a very deep and honest way. And that was really exciting for me with this process.
Yeah, well, it would be. I mean, she is an incredible find or discovery, or coming across someone like Royalty Hightower, even her name clearly, you know, grabs people's attention.
Yeah.
She really holds every scene, doesn't she? It's just
Royalty is
incredible.
Our lead plays Tony. She's just incredible actor, generous, really athletic, and really, but also very grounded. You know, she just was a great collaborator, and we actually found her on day one of auditions. Like I said, she's been dancing with the Q Kids since she was 6 years old, and she was nine when she auditioned, 10 when we filmed. She's 11 now, and she just, you know, she carries the weight of the film. And when we were casting Tony, we knew that she would be in almost every single frame of the film. It's a really challenging role, and it's a role that through every version of the script had very little dialogue. When we collaborated with Royalty, she actually crossed out some of the very few lines that she had.
Oh, okay.
but she's just, yeah, and the you know, she's not anything like Tony as a kid. She's really outgoing and bubbly and confident, and but she's just an amazing actor, and it was a real joy to be able to work with her on this film, and I'm so excited to see what she does next.
Yes. Oh, so she's looking forward to...
She definitely wants to keep
more
acting, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's marvelous. That is very good, because watching her in this film, one gets kind of greedy for what's the next scene going to be like? What is she going to do in the next scene what's going to happen? And it keeps me guessing, where is she? And I, you know, for those, spoiler, for those who haven't seen it, is she next? You know, that's the dread that you've got there as well, when she's standing in that, the empty pool, the big pool there, thinking, oh my God, she's having one of these seizures. And it's this terrible feeling that you have. Is it going to end badly? You know, like a lot of these sort of storylines do that, particularly to a female protagonist. And I was relieved that didn't happen. Well, it didn't seem to happen.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that. It could have become very stereotypical, you know.
Yeah, you know, we were able to play with that, you know, kind of the monster, right? I think also like female bodies in, and when I say horror, we're like just slightly dipping into the horror genre. It's not really a horror film at all. It's sweet and funny in parts, but there's an element of horror to the film. And I think, yeah, audiences have said this, you know, that when you're talking about horror, and particularly female bodies, female adolescent bodies, there's audience expectation about the worst happening constantly. And knowing that, we were able to play with that tension and those fears as this kind of external monster. But what we're talking about is a very internal fear that Tony is going through. And so it's not this external thing that's going to come and get her. It's actually something that's growing inside of her stronger and stronger throughout the entire film. So it was very interesting to play around with that tension. But a lot of audiences we know, and having tested it ahead and now having screened, you know, around the world, that that's something that audiences bring, this fear of what's going to happen, particularly to these young female bodies, in when it starts to get scary. And it was exciting to play, you know, loosely with that, those genre tropes, and kind of that knowing that the audience would bring their own tension to the viewing.
Yeah, those tropes are cleverly played against each other. It did remind me a little bit of The Crucible, you know, the witches, the mass hysteria of girls in that story. People are already familiar with that type of thing, and then you can just manipulate the hell out of them, you know, for the rest of the film.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Which is cruel, but I'm glad you did it. That's great. Now, as a
we hope that we bring you to a good place.
yeah, a very beautiful place. Now, it did remind me a little bit like an MTV video, music video as well, and that gets me to the soundtrack, the score. It's an incredible soundscape, I have to say. It teases the whole, all the scenes get teased by the sounds. So it's, how did you come across the people that we worked with there? Danny and
We actually brought our sound designer Chris Foster on very early.
Okay,
so we were already imagining, like you said, these soundscapes, which we include music in that, but it does also bleed into quite a design space, and that was really exciting because again, we're trying to bring the audience into Tony's perspective constantly.
Yeah.
And when we realized that we needed music to really punctuate throughout and to kind of clue the audience into this quiet discomfort that's kind of brewing in Tony, even before anything starts happening to anyone else around her, there's that element that's inside of her, this this wanting something more, to really punctuate that. And so we brought on Danny Bensi and Sandra Jurian, amazing composers, bass score, Martha Marcy May Marlene, and Enemy, and just have this great body of work that I admire. And what we talked about with them was bringing in this idea of breath, which was very central to all of my discussions with my collaborators. And I really was focusing on listening to breath move through an instrument, a woodwind. And so that it's not just about the end sound that comes out, but all of, you know, miking all of the sounds that happen from the moment breath enters the instrument, the reed noise, the pad noise, and really hearing the breathing was a big part of that. So, and that came out of, you know, the sound design being very breath focused as well. And so it was this kind of eerie, breathy, more noise, I would say, than music. And then as the film goes, we add in all of these other elements, you know, as she's joining forces with the team, these other sounds start to come in, you know, when it's just her, it's kind of this one lone sound, and that kind of builds throughout. You get the clapping bass, and it does start to really become a score. And then, you know, for that end sequence, which is really the most dance on film that the film goes, we did license this incredible song called Aurora by Kia Victoria, and that is something that we found, and then we just arranged it for the end of the film, and it really kind of elevated that sequence, I would say.
Definitely. It blends everything perfectly, and what's, you know, the journey that we see Tony go through, and those other characters around her, her friends and the rest of the team there, or squad, drill team, such.
Yeah.
Which I don't think we have an equivalent here, really. Not in Australia. We don't really. It's very male orientated group sports, team sports, basically.
Yeah.
Which brings.
Is there anyone that performs like field shows? Like,
not as much. Like, I think they do, but it's pretty. Okay. It's a pretty. Yeah, it's not very dominant as such. I'd love to see more. I'm sure there is at school level, but not to this intensity.
Not for young.
Yeah, yeah, Not as broad. Which brings me to a question too about, while we still have some time left, the show that we do is called Broad, and it's a feminist show, a woman's show. How much does, if I can ask you, how much does feminism play into the film? And is that something that's important?
Yeah, like I said, I co-wrote this with two other women, my editor, Celia Davis, and my producer, Lisa Kuroff. And from the beginning, we were very aware that that's a rare thing, to be kind of all of the above-the-line key voices being female. And it felt very unique and exciting. You know, they're my friends, but we had never collaborated in this type of environment. And we really, you know, were in awe of that kind of space that we were able to create together. And with Tony, we really wanted to put, like, a very complex, really full of life human being who happens to be 11 on screen. And I think that so often girls on screen are diminished into these either tropes or objects or plot points, or, you know, they don't really get to bloom and be full. And we were just, you know, I think that those films definitely exist and we're excited by them, but we wanted to add to that space because we felt like there wasn't enough content there. And we also really wanted to make a coming of age film about a young girl that wasn't, you know, focused on really her sexual awakening, but this, you know, we really wanted to focus on, you know, a coming of age story that wasn't about her sexual awakening, which will happen a few years later, but something else that we all experienced, which was about individual awakening and kind of facing yourself for the first time as a human being, as an individual with an identity that you are starting to form, and that's shifting every room you go into. And so that's what we really wanted to tell, that story. And yeah, in terms of feminism, you know, like we all fundamentally believe in equality in a deep way, and you know, we carry these lenses around, these female perspectives around with us every day, and being able to develop that voice for Tony on screen and bring our audiences into her singular point of view was something that was really exciting with this film.
Amazing. Yeah, I totally agree. It's sometimes it's something that you have to say, though, of course, but not necessarily. It's all part of the package as such for what you're doing creatively, which is great to work with your friends. That's cool to get the chance to do that. Now, I wonder before we go, because I've been told...
I mean, they're my friends, but they're like the most some of the most talented people I know.
Well, that's good. Keep the friendship going and keep collaborating. Now, before we go, I wonder if it'd be okay for you to do a show ID tag for us.
It's 94.9.
That's it. Yep.
That's the only 94.9. Okay.
Yep. Cool.
Hi, my name is. Okay.
Yep.
Hi, this is Anna Rose Holmer, director of The Fifth, and you're listening to Joy 94.9.
That's beautiful. Thank you. So what happens now to the film? I mean, it's certainly doing the rounds. It's doing really well. And is there talk of Oscars? Or
yeah, you know, I'm excited to see where it goes. And, you know, if you're interested, you know, grab a ticket and hopefully we can expand even within Australia and around the world. It's, you know, it's each territory is kind of its own new adventure for the film, and it's really exciting. And then, and we'll see, you know, definitely growing in kind of buzz and momentum and supporters, and we're just so appreciative and grateful for everyone for checking out in theaters if you can.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And for you yourself, what are your plans after The Fits, for your team or for yourself?
Well, I'm writing again with Philly Davis, my editor on this project.
Mm-hmm.
She and I are writing another screenplay and just excited to get back to it again.
Yeah, the promotion away from that and get back to the work, the art.
Well,
I want to thank you so much for speaking to us, Anna Rose Holmer.
Oh, I really appreciate it, and thank you so much for including us in the program. It's an honor. Thank you.
No, thank you. And enjoy your coffee, whatever you have, breakfast. I hope you have a restful day.
I have my coffee going. I hope I don't sound too froggy, but I appreciate you chatting with me.
No, I really appreciate it. They never give us 30 minutes normally, so that's good.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, and all the best to you and everybody from The Fits. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Cool. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye. That was the wonderful director, writer, and producer and artist, Anna Rose Holmer, who's created something along with her wonderful squad, her great team of fellow women and good friends, a film called The Fits. The Fits is just 72 minutes long, but you won't be disappointed. It It's a pretty magical little film with a very big, big heart and a wonderful, big, big personality, whom I'm sure we'll hear a lot more of. And that is Toni, or as we know her, Royalty Hightower, who plays the character Toni in The Fitz. The Fitz is playing only at Acme at the moment here in Melbourne Town and will play until July the 10th. So if you haven't seen this film, head along and see it. Get a chance to do it because it's a limited season and we just cross our fingers that just like in the US, it gets extended and delivers to more cinemas around the country here in Oz, which would be fantastic. So you've been listening to Sonia here on Joy 94.9 with the great honour of having talked to Anna Rose Homer. And I hope, like anything, we'll be seeing more of her fabulous work and her team. Let's not forget the people she works with, as she mentioned, Lisa Kudriff and Sayla Davis. This is Sonia on Joy.
By the hand and said I've lost control again. And how I'm This is Michael and Peter Spierig.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi, my name is Madeline Olmec. I'm the director of the Foxy Merkins, and you're listening to Joy 94.9.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lamberg. You might know me as a lesbian cannibal, or sometimes a delusional life-drawing model, or perhaps a neurotic people pleaser. That's right, I'm an actor and director, and this is Sci-Fi and Scream.
This is Matthew A. Brown, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on 94.9.
Hi, this is Erin Gray from Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.